From the Sky News Centre at 5. The UN is calling for an urgent investigation into exactly how Colonel Gaddafi died. It's after footage of the moments before and after his death appear to cast doubt on the official explanation. Meanwhile, NATO are meeting to decide whether to end their operation in the country. Former UK military spokesman Major Mike Shearer hopes that doesn't create new problems.
The real challenge now lies with the transition government unifying the civilians of Libya to a common goal. The only unifying factor there, arguably, was deposing their tyrannical leader.
Anti-capitalist protesters at St Paul's Cathedral say they're not prepared to move on despite the decision to close the historic landmark to the public. The Dean of St Paul's says the makeshift campsite, which has been in the churchyard since Saturday, poses a health and safety risk. This protester insists the good relationship between them doesn't need to end now.
We would love to actually have a conversation with the members of the chapter about the concerns they have, and are still very concerned to be able to try and work through those things. It does seem to me that any issues that were not sort of urgent enough to shut the cathedral a few days ago, I'd be interested to know how they've suddenly become so urgent now.
The man accused of murdering Joanna Yates has been cross-examined for a second day. Vincent Tabak denies there was a sexual motive for the attack, for which he admits manslaughter but denies murder. A man's been jailed for 12 years in Lithuania for attempting to buy and smuggle arms for the real IRA. 39-year-old Michael Campbell from County Louth was arrested in 2008. Jaguar is recalling almost 18,000 cars due to a cruise control problem. The issue affects diesel-engined X-Type models from 2006 to 2010. And Tintin star Jamie Bell says he wants to play the character for another 20 years. The actor takes on the role in Steven Spielberg's adaptation. That's the latest. I'm Adam Lindsay.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Hello Bristol and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and helping review this week's news is Chair of the Overview and Scrutiny Management and Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Derek Pickup. And also old Labour Oxford economist is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, we go back over 20 years to the Sheffield Wednesday Hillsborough disaster, where 96 Liverpool fans were crushed to death and then had the indignity of being blamed by the Sun newspaper. But one former South Yorkshire Police employee has submitted an extraordinary witness statement to the Hillsborough Inquiry panel and tells me of a conversation he had in the canteen at the headquarters. Paints a disturbing picture of how events unfolded that day. Plus, the Occupy Bristol campsite has sprung up on College Green this week. What's it all about? Tom Baldwin's here from the Youth Fight Against For Jobs campaign to explain and tell us of plans of a new Jarrow March against mass unemployment. And on a similar theme, local disabled people will be marching tomorrow against government cuts to disabled benefits. Tara Melton and Jenny Hodges are along to explain how the coalition government's cuts are affecting the most vulnerable in society. And SHWAG, that's the NHS, after it's been privatised, an organisation has been set up to support health service whistleblowers as the privatisation rolls out, as many people believe it is being privatised. Plus, where is Werity? That was the headline in the Daily Mail article this week about the invisible advisor and the resignation of Defence Secretary and North Somerset Conservative MP Liam Fox. Martin Summers explains the backstory of what looks increasingly like a veritable mole at the heart of the Ministry of Defence. That's in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 degrees Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 16, and that's sunny and cooler on Saturday, cloudier, warmer, but windy on Sunday. Next week, highs of 16 Celsius, warmer at the beginning of the week, a mixture of cloudy, sunny and windy towards the end. And next weekend, the 29th and 30th of October, highs of 13 Celsius, sunny spells and some gusty winds, but thankfully little rain over the next couple of weeks. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests, and joining us is the Chair of the Overview and Scrutiny Management Committee, which I'll be asking about in a minute, and also Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Derek Pickup. Hi, Derek, and welcome to Drive Time.
How do you do? Good afternoon, everybody.
Now, tell us what your day job is, Derek. You're not a counsellor all the time, I imagine.
No, unfortunately, even counsellors have to go out and make a living. So I work for an organisation which just rebranded itself, called the Youth Network, formerly known as the Kingswood Foundation, and I'm their development director. And the key project that we're working on at the moment is that we just bought the old fire station in Broadmead, and we're developing that into a huge youth facility for the whole of Bristol.
Can you tell us about the city's youth service? How does it work?
Well, at the moment, most of the youth provision is provided by the City Council, and then some of it is commissioned out to local organisations. As you probably know, because of the fact that the government's restricting the amount of money that's available to local government, we're having to relook at how the youth service is configured in Bristol. As you know, I'm a member of the Labour Party, so we're not actually in control in Bristol. It's currently the Liberal Democrats. And what they're looking at doing is, in fact, commissioning out the entire service from the City Council.
Well, why is that? What's the point of... for a lot of people, this is actually means that the council will actually have less control about what goes on if they're commissioning service from outside providers.
Well, I think there's probably two reasons behind it. First thing, if you've only got a certain amount of money, you can commission it out and say, we've got X amount to spend. And then if there are any cuts, they say, well, no, we didn't make any cuts, we commissioned out the service. So what it tends to do is hide the cuts. So whereas there's 12 million, I think, been going into the youth service, they're planning to reduce that to 8 million. So already, you know, it hides a big cut. Secondly, there's a feeling that if you commission it out and it goes to the voluntary sector will be able to provide the service more effectively, cut out some of the bureaucracy, and provide the service at a lower cost. I don't think that always works.
Now, what changes have you seen over the last 3 or 4 years then in the way that the youth service is actually provided on the ground, never mind who's actually doing the provision?
Well, I think one of the big problems, I think, with youth services, not only in Bristol but across the country, is that gradually over the last 10 years or more, most local authorities have gradually reduced the amount going into youth provision. And, you know, one of the problems is that's resulted in lots of young people saying, there is nothing to do where I live. And I think that's one of the problems. And it's one of the reasons why young people say that they feel so disengaged from society, because they say it's got nothing to provide for us.
What about the what you're doing then? How do people access that service? And generally speaking, if there are young people or parents around the city that are interested in their children going along to these kinds of youth service, how do they access it?
Well, I mean, the difference in terms of what we're doing is that we're providing stuff through the voluntary sector. We advertise what we're doing in all sorts of different ways, but most of it probably goes from word of mouth to young people. The difference is, in terms of the organisation that I'm working with, is that currently we work out of Kingswood. We're now going to be moving into the centre of Bristol. One of the things is that because more and more local government is not able to provide youth-type facilities in every community, more and more young people are saying, well, if we can't have something locally, how can we easily access something? And by providing a very large facility in the centre of the city with a whole range of different activities that is reasonably easy to get to if you've got access to public transport. Because one of the big problems with Bristol is it's a bit like the hub of a wheel. You can go from the centre outside to different communities and from those communities into the centre. What you can't do is go across communities. And so we're hoping when we open the station project in a year's time that we'll be providing a service that's accessible to anyone, any young person who lives across Bristol.
We've got things like the guides and scouts huts dotted across the city. But are there areas now, do you think, where actually there is very little provision locally? Because this is something that people want to do, particularly young people. They just want to walk down the road to something. They don't necessarily want to get on a bus and go into the city centre and back again. And also, they can't necessarily afford the bus fares.
Well, I think there's huge areas of the city now where youth provision is very sparse. And I think once you actually reach the stage that the City Council commissions out the service which now looks like it's going to be 2013 because it's been a more difficult process than they'd anticipated. The problem is that what they're doing is they're saying these are the outcomes that we want. They're not saying we want a youth facility in every area. They're saying we want there to be provision for young people. We want it to provide the following. What it doesn't say is we want local youth provision. And what many of the youth projects which are currently in the voluntary sector feel is that because they're not big enough to actually bid to be part of this commissioning, that whoever wins the contract won't actually have sufficient money to include all those current facilities, so that some of them will drop off the edge, and so that the provision that there is now will be shrinking dramatically.
Well, what about this committee that you're chairing on the City Council, the Overview and Scrutiny Management? It sounds a little bit of a mouthful.
Well, Overview and Scrutiny Management, like everything any organisation does, the work that's done by Bristol City Council has to be scrutinised to see how well it's doing things, and when it does say it's doing something, we have to look and examine how it's doing it, and also try and look if there's better ways of doing things. And the overview for each area of work that the council does, there is a scrutiny committee, and then the overview and scrutiny committee overviews the work of the other scrutiny commissions.
So you can't have your eyes and ears everywhere, so you're really relying on these other scrutiny committees to be telling you what to be looking at, are you?
We are, and you know, one of the big problems is there's so many different areas to look at that you can't look at everything. And certainly, you know, youth provision and youth service is something that the Scrutiny Commission has been looking at, the Young Person Scrutiny Commission, and certainly Overview and Scrutiny has also been looking at it. And we did say to the Liberal Democrats that it needed more time to look at this issue. About how we were going to actually, if they were going to commission out the services, whether that was the best way to do it or whether it was best to have a mix of provision like we do now, and that we felt it was far more complicated than they'd envisaged and that we needed to look at it in greater detail. Now, fortunately, they are going to take more time at looking at it, but I still think the end result's going to be the same, because whatever we do, central government is determined to reduce services provided by local government, and we already know that Bristol's going to have to reduce 21 million in next year's budget on top of all the cuts that they made in the current financial year. Now, normally we would have the draft budget for next year would have already been produced for us to start to scrutinise. We think the current administration are having problems, and it's not actually going to be produced until the 23rd of November, which will give us a very short time period to actually look at, scrutinise and comment on before it actually comes to full council for approval.
Yeah, there are rumours around that actually there's been an overspend already this year, and that maybe that's one of the reasons why it's taken a while, an extra bit of time for the administration to come up with a budget.
Well, there are certainly areas of the council that have been overspending, particularly when you look at things like adult social services, children's services. We're told that by the end of the financial year they would hope to be more within budget, but we don't know. We shall wait and see. I think it's going to be a very big problem to come in budget, and it's going to be a very big problem to find £21 million worth of additional savings in the next financial year. And when we look at the papers, we're being told that inflation is at an all-time high. Well, if we're making a £21 million cut and we're not allowing for the levels of inflation there are, you know, the cut's going to be even bigger.
And we're also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, we're going to start today by having a listen to King Mervyn. Mervyn King, who I sort of imagine him sitting on a kind of throne in charge of everybody, including the government. He's been up in Liverpool this week, and let's just have a little listen to what he had to say.
I want to explain why the global nature of the crisis means that monetary and fiscal policy in the United Kingdom can do only so much. Our fate rests to a considerable extent on the policies pursued by our trading partners. That's why, at last weekend's G20 meetings in Paris, the Chancellor and I put such weight on this interdependence among the major economies. Countries have responsibilities to each other, and we need to work with our partners overseas to find a solution to present problems. 4 years into the crisis, it's surely time to accept that the underlying problem is one of solvency, not liquidity. Solvency of banks and solvency of countries.
I think Martin Summers speaking here, I think Mervyn King is exactly right to put his finger on the fact that it's not a liquidity problem, it's a solvency problem. And the difference for listeners is that liquidity is basically money. It's like you haven't got enough money to pay your bills, and if you're given some leeway, you can pay them. Insolvency is where you cannot pay them, whatever you do. And the banking system is insolvent. In the 1930s, the banking system was largely illiquid, but not insolvent. This time, it's insolvent. The banks are bust. They've been chucking money at them for the last 4 years, which has kept them going, just about, as going concerns, partly because they've been allowed to basically carry out accounting fraud and account all of the junk they've got on their books as if it was worth full value, whereas the best estimates are it's worth perhaps 20% of the book value. So in other words, all the banks are bust, and the governments have been chucking money at the system in the hopes that somehow they will not be bust. We've reached the end of the line on this. And Mervyn King also said, not in that clip, but he also said this is the worst financial disaster since the Second World War, possibly ever. And I think when central bankers are talking like that, people should get up and listen, because central bankers, one of their jobs is to calm everybody down and talk in a calm tone of voice. So when you've got the head of the Bank of England saying this is the worst financial crisis ever, you can pretty much bet that it is the worst financial crisis ever.
Now, he's not just talking about the banks, is he? He's saying that the countries are also insolvent.
And that's one of the sleights of hand that is going on. Countries are insolvent because the banks were rescued. And basically, what's happened is that the taxpayers of the various countries have pledged their taxes into the indefinite future to keep the private banking system afloat. Now, what should have happened when the banks were nationalised, which is effectively what happened, and Gordon Brown was quite solid about that eventually after the Irish had pushed him, once you've nationalised the banks, you've got to run them. And what they've done is they've basically chucked money at the private banks so that they can carry on being private banks. What they should have done is allowed them to go bust and then take over the infrastructure. You don't pay RBS and Lloyds if they're bankrupt, you just take them over. Then you run them in such a way that you outcompete the existing investment banks, push them aside, and basically you're moving towards a publicly run credit system. Now, none of the political parties have been willing to push for that. I mean, Ed Balls at the Labour Party conference said, with the windfalls we will get from selling RBS and Lloyds back to the private sector, we will pay off debts. Now, he said that to keep the City of London happy, but basically that's rubbish. RBS and Lloyds are more in the hole now than they were when we took them over. But basically the taxpayers lost a fortune on bailing them out. We're not making any money out of it, and the idea that we're going to sell them back to the private sector at a profit is frankly fantastical. And that shows that even Ed Balls, who's probably more on the ball than virtually anybody else about this, is still way behind the curve. The banking system is going to collapse, and then we're going to talk seriously about what needs to be done, and it's not going to be what we've been doing in the past.
Now, you're talking about it coming to the end of the line. It sounds like a train sort of running out of steam.
Well, I think
what's going to happen when the train actually gets to the end of the line? Is that just mean that the economy grinds to a
halt? Well, there's two possibilities here. The European Union may come up with an orderly default for Greece, which will involve basically the bondholders taking at least a 50% and probably a 70% cut in what they're owed. Now, if the banks, like Dexia Bank last week in Belgium, if they have to take a 70% cut in what they're owed for Greece, then they will go bust. But what that point, the EU has to nationalise the banking system and bust the US banks and the British banks. Now, that's why Tim Geithner and George Osborne and Mervyn King are running around. They know very well that if there's a disorderly default default of Greece, then the banks will go down. And if there's an orderly default, in which case the bondholders take a massive haircut, the banks will go down, and that will crash the US and British banks. Don't forget that the City of London is right at the heart of the mess. So any small country anywhere goes bust, the City of London goes bust automatically.
But surely, thankfully, we're out of the euro, so we're out of the worst.
Doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference. The British banks are owed a massive amount of money by the German and French banks. So if the German and French banks go down, the British banks will go down. And that's just if Greece defaults. If Brazil defaults, or a big country like that, the whole banking system will go down. In 1998, long-term capital management went bust. That's one hedge fund. And the US and the IMF had to step in and bail it out, or the whole banking system would go down. The whole banking system has been backstopped by the taxpayer since Mexico was back to default in 1982. But basically, the governments have now run out of money to chuck into this black hole, and therefore the crash will happen. But most of the political class are still living in the past, where capitalism somehow looks after itself, and all they've got to do is argue about distributing the spoils. That is about to change. And we used to have Labour politicians who understood all of this and actually had a socialist agenda. We're going to need them again.
Well, we used to have Liberal and Conservative politicians.
Liberal politicians are like this. Yes, Keynes was a Liberal and Harold Macmillan was a Conservative politician. I don't think Harold Macmillan or Edward Heath will be cutting public expenditure at this moment. They understood that it was suicidal.
Okay, so I suppose the ultimate question here is this crash, is it, or the that you say we're heading towards, is there an element of just ignorance about it, or is there comes some kind of
the political class are largely ignorant about it, and they're taken by surprise by events.
But what about the bankers? Have they just made a mistake, or is
the low-level traders just do what they do on a daily basis, and they don't see the bigger picture? But Goldman Sachs, for example, at one stage were designing some of the junk they were selling to fail, and the senior managers were taking short positions on their own derivatives.
So is this just a way of making money for these big banks, or is there a Martin? Just let me finish the question. Or is there a political agenda?
The banks have become enormously politically powerful because once they were bailed out, they were then in a position to buy the political process. So the biggest single contributor to the Obama campaign was Goldman Sachs. And Wall Street provided more than 50% of his money, which is why, of course, Tim Geithner is his economic supremo rather than somebody like Joe Stiglitz, who went down to talk to the protesters in Wall Street the other day. Basically, all of the people who should be running Obama's economic policy are still in the universities, and Wall Street have been allowed to carry on doing what they're doing, which is a real problem, because you've got Obama, who's no goose, and the Republicans, who are even worse. And that's why people are getting totally frustrated by mainstream politics, because it doesn't seem to matter who gets elected, the bankers always win.
Derek, you're a Labour councillor here in the city. What's your take on this? I mean, Martin's given us a sort of global view. What's your view from the city here?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when times are hard, it's up to government step in and actually not cut expenditure but spend money. And if you look back to what some of the European countries did, for example in the 20s, you'll see that some European countries had huge public projects where they were employing people so that they weren't sitting at home doing nothing. And I think if government was looking at things properly, what they would realise is that actually the public sector has become much more important as part of the economy, and even the private sector has relied on it very heavily for part of its income.
And the trouble is, of course, if we spend more money, politicians and our government spend more money, where's that going to come from?
Well, it's like most things. If you spend money, people pay taxes, people are using money. So not only are you spending money, but you're also taking money in. And if you actually want to stimulate an economy so that you've actually got money flowing through it, then people have to have confidence in that economy. If all you're doing is cutting and cutting back, you just go into a decline.
Okay, on to another story. And we had the death of Colonel Gaddafi yesterday was announced. And we got Paul Davies here from the Saturday Sport programme to do a short report on that.
So, the world has toppled yet another dictator. Saddam Hussein, Anwar Sadat, Hosni Mubarak, Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, etc., etc. Why didn't we see sense and bring Mr. Gaddafi in for a Nuremberg-style trial along the lines of the one given in The Hague to Slobodan Milosevic and the remnants of the Nazi regime in Germany? With the assumed assassination of Colonel Gaddafi at 12:30 p.m. Libyan time after 42 years in control, rebel tribes and the interim government of the African Arab state are now rejoicing on the streets, whilst the West politicians, aka David Cameron and Barack Obama, are pushed out front to toe the line. Indeed, the rest of us are being encouraged by our mass media to have a party. When Gaddafi was captured, he was said to be still alive, and then he was dead. Surely international law stipulates a dictator should be kept alive, tried, and then subsequently put to death only after he is found guilty of crimes committed. In a scenario reminiscent of Saddam Hussein's capture, the Libyan leader was discovered inside a hole in his hometown of Siirt, apparently alive before being shot. The National Transitional Council, currently in power in Libya, say Gaddafi was shot through the side of the head after a crossfire between rebel and government troops as he was being driven in a truck to hospital following a NATO strike on his convoy. A conflicting story says he resisted arrest upon capture, was paraded through the streets and shot in the head and stomach before dying soon after on the way to Misrata. The uprising was inspired by events in neighbouring Tunisia and Egypt and sparked by the arrest of a Libyan human rights campaigner in February of this year. Hundreds were killed as authorities tried to suppress the revolt, and some of the biggest demonstrations were seen in the eastern port of Benghazi, the centre of arrest. The novelist Idris Al-Mezmari was arrested hours after giving an interview with Al Jazeera about the police reaction to protests in Benghazi on the 15th of February. As of the 25th of August, the rebels were in open rebellion against Gaddafi's forces, with the opposition controlling the majority of military bases in the east and west of the country and most of the capital, Tripoli. Most nations strongly condemned Gaddafi's use of force against civilians. United Nations Security Council passed a resolution to enforce a no-fly zone over Libyan airspace on the 17th of March. The UN resolution authorised airstrikes against Libyan ground troops and warships posing a threat to civilians. On 19th of March, the no-fly zone enforcement began, with French aircraft undertaking sorties across Libya and a naval blockade by the British Royal Navy. Over 90 countries have recognised the anti-Gaddafi National Transitional Council as Libya's legislative representative. However, countries such as China, Turkey and Brazil abstained from the UN resolution vote, and Amnesty International has this week called for a public inquiry on the whole affair. But are the British, French and American governments really going to criticise their own military intervention in supporting the rebels through NATO airstrikes? In the long term, are we seriously after Libya's oil reserves? Financial markets around the world had adverse reactions to the instability, with oil prices rising to a 2.5-year high. On the flip side of things, perhaps we should be glad that Gaddafi has gone. For a number of decades, he sponsored IRA terrorism in Ireland, backed the terrorist killing of PC Yvonne Fletcher outside the Libyan embassy in London, plus the Lockerbie bombing over Scotland, resulting in the deaths of innocent civilians in the air and on the ground. He has also executed numerous Libyan citizens who spoke out against the regime, just like Saddam did in Iraq. Political commentators say a power vacuum left in Libya will result in infighting between the tribes. Will there be a civil war, like in Ireland in 1922, when the British army pulled out the south of the country? UN Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon called this week's events an historic moment, but warned, and I quote, "The road ahead for Libya and its people will be difficult and full of challenges." Officials say the National Transitional Council has intended to announce the liberation of the country in the coming days, allowing them to begin pushing through democratic reforms that will lead to elections. In conclusion, is it right for Western governments to get involved in the domestic affairs of Eastern countries? Do we have the military resources to fight numerous conflicts? You can look at regimes in Syria, Morocco, Yemen, Jordan and Algeria and say we should be protecting their citizens' freedom to speak out. I am all for coups supported by Western governments as long as they are releasing the population from poverty and torture and restoring freedom of speech, but not to solely steal a country's oil resources for our energy gains in the long term. What is morally wrong is to feed these green-eyed monsters over the years with arms manufactured by Western companies in the name of profit. These weapons are then being used against neighbouring countries to fight wars and even against their own peoples. Who's next on the dictator list? Mugabe in Zimbabwe? Or would our own Queen have something to say about that?
That's Paul Davis's report there. Thanks very much, Paul. And you can hear Paul tomorrow on Saturday Sport between 1 and 3. Now, Derek, can I just have your first take on this whole business of the death of Gaddafi? Maybe first about the right or wrongs of the NATO intervention, and secondly on the way Gaddafi died.
Well, I'm quite amazed the way that Gaddafi's died and the way that it's being portrayed on the media. We know that given mass communications, we're seeing so many things, if you like, as they happen. And I'm surprised, one, that we were able to see what was happening so quickly, and that the pictures that have been released both on the internet and on the news channels are so graphic. One would have anticipated that if the regime against Gaddafi was working with the West, that a procedure would have been agreed with them for when they found Gaddafi, and it would have gone to a trial in The Hague.
Martin.
Well, I'd like to make two comments about this. First of all, if you look on the French Air Force website, you'll see that from the 1st of November last year, they had a war game entitled Operation Southern Mistral 2011. And that war game was between the French Air Force and the British Air Force, and it was exactly what happened. Now, the Islamic...
Well, it was a war game.
It was a war game, but it was exactly what... What happened in the war game was that the south of France was called Southland, which is actually, of course, just in... if you move further south, you arrive in Libya. And there was going to be a popular uprising in which the planes would then be used against the demonstrators, which would then lead to a UN resolution, which would then lead to a joint attack by US, by British and RAF and French Air Force on in support of an uprising. The Islamic Fighting Group of Libya have been working with MI6 for the last 30 years. So when Shayla and Annie Machon left MI5 in the 90s, the reason they left was because they were working with the Islamic Fighting Group of Libya to assassinate Gaddafi. Now, the other point I would make about Lockerbie and WPC Yvonne Fletcher, I saw that you put up on the internet last night, Tony, two very interesting films that were made in the 90s, one by Dispatches about the WPC Fletcher affair, and another one, the Maltese Double Cross, which was also shown on Channel 4, about what happened at Lockerbie. The reason why they had to release Megrahi was because a Scottish police inspector was about to testify at Megrahi's appeal that the CIA had interfered with the crime scene at Lockerbie, to wit, had planted the circuit board which implicated the Libyans. And if you think about it for a second, there isn't going to be a circuit board. If a bomb's gone off and vaporised an aeroplane, the circuit board from the bomb will not be there.
Well, it didn't vaporise the aeroplane.
Well, yeah, but the point is that the bomb, that you don't find a bit of circuit board from a bomb. That's the first point. The second point is that this police inspector was going to testify that the CIA had interfered with the crime scene. That is why the Scottish Parliament agreed to him being sent back to Libya. And if Megrahi was put back on trial, I look forward to it. I mean, he's dying now. They'd be damn fools if they did put him on trial, because Libya didn't do it. And in actual fact, the suspicion falls actually on the CIA. And we should be sending Scottish police officers to Langley, Virginia, and say, you've been interfering with our crime scene. Now, nobody wants to go down that road. Gaddafi has been used as a punch bag for years by the West. They've supplied him with arms when it suited them, and they've tried to overthrow him when it suited them. I hope the Libyans are able to find some stable political way through this. But don't forget, at least a third of the population support Gaddafi. They may not have majority support, but Gaddafi has called for an insurrection against the rebels, who are in fact Al-Qaeda Libya. There's no doubt about that. So, and the West is supporting them and has been for years. And people have got to recognise what's going on here. The Al-Qaeda, in most manifestations, is absolutely run by Western intelligence services and has been for donkey's years. As Robin Cook said, Al-Qaeda was originally the database kept in a man Jordan of all the people recruited by MI6 who were in charge of Operation Cyclone and filtered into Afghanistan to fight the Soviets.
Okay,
that's the history.
Martin, one of the other aspects to this is the way that Gaddafi died. I mean, Paul was talking there about the idea of having a trial possibly at the International Criminal Court, possibly in Libya, and then eventually the death penalty. But actually, we don't have the death penalty in this part of the world. What are your thoughts about that side of things, Derek?
Well, I personally still support the fact that in Britain we don't have the death penalty. But when you're talking about international incidents like this, it would be dealt with by The Hague and under international law.
I think the fact is they didn't want to put Saddam on trial at The Hague, because, of course, the first thing Saddam's going to say, call Donald Rumsfeld, you sold me all that kit. And the same thing is going to happen if Gaddafi's put on trial. His lawyers are going to say, call all these Western powers, call Tony Blair, you said it was all right for me to do this, that and the other. That's why it's so much easier, because dead men tell no tales. Maybe he's not dead as well. The so-called assassination of Osama bin Laden in Pakistan the other week, nobody in Pakistan believes that. nobody. And it's all very well. Middle-class people in middle-income countries believe all these things. Out there in the real world where people are fighting and dying all the time, they don't believe a word we say.
One of the things Derek picked up on also was the way that the death was covered yesterday, with really graphic pictures of a dying man being shown on daytime television, which, of course, children would have access to watch. And I just wonder, Martin, what your thoughts are.
Well, I mean, let's put it this way. There is no rule of law involved in this. And I supported a no-fly zone to begin with, because there was a no-fly zone in Bosnia when I was an aid worker, and it was quite useful. It just stopped them using aircraft. But, of course, the Russians gave a press conference saying there was no evidence whatsoever for Gaddafi using aircraft. That was in the war game, but it never actually happened on the ground. Now, in actual fact, like most wars in history, everybody's in the wrong. And how many people have died in this little episode? 30,000? 40,000? And is Libya going to be the same again? Perhaps not, because, of course, the Gaddafi people are now going to go to insurgency, as the people did in Iraq and as they did in Afghanistan. I'll bet you we may be still fighting in Libya in another 10 years as we were fighting in Afghanistan today.
So, Derek, as someone that works with young people, do you think that questions should be asked about of the broadcasters about broadcasting this footage? I mean, maybe after the watershed, but certainly I found it a bit shocking that this is 4 or 5, 6 o'clock in the afternoon.
Well, I think the whole issue of what can be shown to, you know, young people before the watershed is something that's been well rehearsed in the past, and I think that the news should follow the guidelines that everybody else has to follow. And I don't think it's appropriate for this to be shown to children and young people. I don't think it's the kind of thing that they should be seeing, and to be perfectly frank, it's the kind of thing that shouldn't actually be happening.
Well, that's right. It's just illegal. It's as simple as that. Whoever shot Gaddafi should be arrested and prosecuted. You want to keep these people alive, because then you can find out more. Once they're dead, you can't find out what went on.
Well, maybe that was part of why he died.
Exactly.
Potentially. Anyway, finally on this subject, let's have a listen to David Cameron's statement yesterday on the death of Colonel Gaddafi.
Prime Minister Jibril has confirmed that Colonel Gaddafi is dead. I think today is a day to remember all of Colonel Gaddafi's victims, from those who died in connection with the Pan Am flight over Lockerbie, to Yvonne Fletcher in a London street, and obviously all the victims of IRA terrorism who died through their use of Libyan Semtex. We should also remember the many, many Libyans who died at the hands of this brutal dictator and his regime. People in Libya today have an even greater chance after this news of building themselves a strong and democratic future. I'm proud of the role that Britain has played in helping them to bring that about, and I pay tribute to the bravery of the Libyans who've helped to liberate their country. We will help them, we will work with them, and that is what I want to say today. Thank you.
That was David Cameron speaking yesterday outside 10 Downing Street. Labour councillor Derek Pickup, at the very least here, now at least we've got rid of one brutal dictator, and I think that's what David Cameron's underlining there.
Yeah, but I think one of the problems is with countries that we've already been to. You know, if you look at what's been happening in Iraq, if you look what's been happening in Afghanistan, if you now look what's happening in Libya, that there's no guarantee that you're going to have a regime that's any better than what there's been in the past. So it's almost like throwing a dice to see exactly what might happen next. And I think there's no guarantees in any of this. So, you know, I don't think we can be complacent, and I don't think we can feel that this is the end of the line, and I don't think anybody's got a crystal ball which will tell us exactly what will happen. I think we're in a situation that's going to go on for many years yet. Whether the end result will be better or not for the Libyan people, I think we've yet to find out.
I think that's absolutely right. And of course, we've now legitimised bloody revolution. And I look forward to the RAF supporting the rebels in Saudi Arabia and in Bahrain and maybe in Yemen against Saleh. Oh, no, hang on a minute. We're bombing Yemen against the people who are trying to rebel against President Saleh. This is all incredibly kind of partial, isn't it? But I'm afraid the Palestinians and everybody else, the Libyans have shown the way. It's bloody revolution all the way. And everybody in charge is a legitimate target, and their children. King Fahd of Saudi Arabia and his children, it's a hereditary monarchy. Let's put them up against the wall and shoot them, eh? Because there's no rule of law, there's no rules.
Well, is that what you're saying there, Martin, is surely is a bit shocking. I mean, that's
You know, you can't.
That's the
be
logic
calling.
Of the British position, isn't it? The logic of the British position is that armed rebellion is absolutely justified. Shooting people in the head, if they're repressing their people, they've got to die. So that's President Saleh, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, the King of Bahrain, Saleh running Yemen, and basically the Palestinians are going to have to start an intifada. Obviously, I mean, there's no point talking anymore. And we'll put in a no-fly zone over Gaza when the Israelis try and bomb them with white phosphorus, won't we? Ha ha.
Well, Derek, what do you think about that? What Martin's saying, double standards there, saying actually that what they're doing is they're trying to pretend that the armed revolution in Libya is the same as these more peaceful revolutions, much more peaceful revolutions in places like Egypt and also Wall Street, these kind of peaceful occupations.
Well, I think all governments, when they're trying to decide what to do, are trying to see what benefits them the most. In some situations, it benefits them to move in and take action. In other situations, it benefits them to stay behind the scenes. So I think, you know, they're making different choices in different situations. I think we've reached a point at the moment, though, where the main players around the world now are getting caught up in so many different situations. You know, I don't think they've got the capacity to be at war with everybody all over the place.
Okay, on to another story now, and a reality check. How much is the Dale Farm eviction costing? This is the Basildon Travellers who were evicted yesterday, finally, after several years, from what was a scrapyard in Essex. The reason I say reality check is, yes, how much is it costing? And I sat down and worked out that around about 200 three-bedroom homes could have been built for the price of this eviction. Derek, what were your thoughts seeing the way this whole thing proceeded and yesterday the final scenes of people being removed from this traveller site?
Well, I mean, it has to be said that it's you know, it's gone to a position of farce. You're exactly right that the amount of money that's been thrown at this is utterly outrageous. As you said, rather than throw the people out, they could have actually built a housing estate and rehoused everybody on the site. But if you look around the whole country, the whole issue of travellers has not been well handled anywhere in the country. You find that local authorities are supposed to have a duty to actually provide space for travellers, and the vast majority of local authorities don't fulfil that obligation. So you can go anywhere in the country and you find that local authorities have not been meeting those obligations. And I think to go out and spend so much money on removing something which in the end could have been left there, and as you're saying, they were occupying what was formerly a scrapyard. It can't have been worse than it was, and I think it beggars belief what's happened.
Now, I was down in Basildon a few weeks ago, and whilst I was in Basildon town centre, I had a wander around and asked some of the local residents what they thought of this eviction, that this was putting Basildon on the map.
I've never had any problem with the travellers, and if they're there, then they're not interrupting anyone else's parklands or anything, so I don't see any problem with them being there personally.
I don't think they should be able to stay there permanently. I think they should be able to have somewhere to stay, but if they're going to be called travellers, you know what I mean? They've got to travel, they can't stay in one place, can they?
I'd say the same as her. Give them somewhere to live if you're going to evict them, simple as that.
No, they don't have planning permission. They aren't exempt from any other the rules that everyone else...
They're doing no harm, as simple as that.
They're not doing harm. They should have a right to stay somewhere if they're travelling around. They should have places to go.
We've got a government on about opening up Bleeding Greenbelt. That's Greenbelt. Open it up and let them stay.
It's actually very difficult nowadays to be a traveller.
It is very, even with my granddad, he only goes camping like on holidays through the summer, and he can't even pull up on the side of the road and camp in his camper van anymore because he gets told to move on. So I don't know how they're meant to survive. Like, you can't, can you, travel? Mm. They need to be given specific places where they can stop over in each town, I reckon. Everybody, not just travellers, everybody who wants to travel about.
They should go because normal people have to have planning permission and pay to get anything done. They've got it for nothing.
But why not give planning permission to people who want to live there?
Because councils probably get a backhander from them.
Actually, I've worked over at that site for quite a few times actually, and I've always found the travellers right over there, to be honest with you. No problems with them being there either. I mean, if they could come to a peaceful solution over there, fine by us as well, we'll leave them there. I don't think they're doing any harm over there. It was only a scrapyard before they was there, I believe, wasn't it? Providing they abide by the rules over there, I mean, we've got no problem with them there at all, really, to be honest with you.
we should leave them alone and leave them where they are. They've set up a good community there and should leave them well alone. Why? Because they're there already. It'll probably cost us less money to rehouse them than to evict them the way we're going about it now. So why don't we rehome them?
Give them homes.
They should have stopped it from the very, very beginning rather than let it become a big, big community like it already is.
Well, it's a difficult one because I think it's all right for me to say give them a chance because they don't live next door to me. But if they lived next door to me, I wouldn't like it. You know, it's just freedom, really. But if they lived abidedly, like law-abiding citizens, I don't think there'd be a problem. Well, rumours are that they go around stealing things and causing trouble. So I think it's a tough one, really. And I just think they always seem to have money. And why can't they pay rent like everybody else? I don't know. I think it's just the way it's all been done is a bit harsh. Do you know what I mean? But I think they've tried for years and apparently it's costing so much money to evict them when we need money. Do you know what I mean? So, yes, because they don't live next door to me. No, if they live next door to me.
In this day and age, they could have something like a modern prefab, like a Scandinavian type buildings, which is semi-permanent. And if need be, if they've got to be moved, they can be moved, but it would enable people to live instead of being cramped all on top of one another.
Just give us a little bit of land, we'll give up what we've got there, somebody else can live there and we live on just the same as they do, but you wouldn't be allowed.
That was people shopping in Basildon Town Centre a few weeks ago. Martin, I wonder what you've heard there and what you think about this whole story generally with 18 million, well, 18 million pounds. Martin, can I please finish? £18 million being spent on this eviction.
Well, it's quite ridiculous. I mean, £18 million, you could have actually brought the site up to standard and say, hey, we'll use this site as one of the sites we're supposed to provide for you. When they say they haven't got planning permission, that's just because the council didn't give them planning permission. It was within the council's gift to give them planning permission. They chose not to. What you've got there is Tory politicians basically running an anti-traveller thing because they think it's going to get them votes. But I'm very pleased to hear the common sense there from those Essex boys and girls saying, well, if they're not causing any bother, why don't we leave well alone? I mean, leaving well alone is quite a useful principle, you know. It actually solves a lot of problems.
Derek, what's your thoughts about what you've heard there, and also, you know, how Bristol City Council deals with travellers, and do we provide enough sites?
Bristol City Council, I don't think, has ever provided enough sites. They've had lots of difficulties in trying to find sites that people, you know, local people find acceptable. It's as one of the commentators there said, we don't mind where the travellers go, providing it's not in my back door, because there's always all sorts of rumours of what happens if you have travellers living near you. I know that some of the sites that we've provided, providing they've been managed appropriately, we've had no problems at all. But actually the fuss that you have to go through to actually get a traveller's site agreed and actually get the travellers living there is huge. Once they're actually there and things have settled down, there isn't a problem. And so I think, you know, there's always a problem with politicians that unfortunately you do have to be elected by the general public. And a lot of politicians are frightened to actually stand for some of these things and actually give their approval for things like traveller sites because, quite frankly, they're frightened of the backlash from local voters. But our experience, I think, in Bristol has been that if we've looked at a site, if we've done the appropriate consultation, if we manage it effectively, if we make sure that it's appropriate size, that there aren't the problems that have come through. And I think it's very interesting talking, the people who've commented in Basildon are basically saying, well, they haven't really been causing us any problems. And if they haven't been causing them problems, why on earth did they spend so much money in trying to move them? Particularly at a time where, you know, we're being told that very essential services are going to be slashed. You know, I'd far rather see that money being spent on more services to the elderly. I'd far rather see them, you know, maintaining our schools, to keeping the youth service. Why on earth do they want to waste millions and millions of pounds on achieving basically nothing? Because all those travellers have moved, have still got to have somewhere to live. All they've done is displaced an issue. They haven't actually resolved anything by this action.
What about this sort of principle, which is something which has changed over the last 15, 20 years or so, which is the inability of people to actually stop by the side of the road anymore? Because if you go down many of our lanes in Gloucestershire and Wiltshire, you find massive wide verges, which traditionally were used by people to just stop by the side of the road and spend the night there. I mean, if you go back long enough, you'll probably find that they were horse-drawn and they were using the verges to feed their horses, but that's now totally illegal.
Well, I think there has been a paranoia that's built up that if people stop, it's going to attract more people. So, you know, one caravan stops, it's going to bring two, it's going to be three. So people have been moved on. I think it's unfortunate that this paranoia is now affecting everyone around the country. And, you know, one of the things that has been very popular, I think, in Britain for many, many years is people going out and camping. And certainly in situations where there's less money about, you're going to find more people are not going to go abroad in their holidays. They're going to stay in this country, and they're actually want to go and travel around the country. They're going to want to be camping. And I think there should be a certain amount of freedom.
Martin, what are your thoughts about this idea of the verges by the side of the road? Is about 1993, the Criminal Justice Act, meant that if you did stop, even just for half an hour or so by the side of the road, even if it was to feed your horse, suddenly the police would be told, or would, if the police car drove past, they would then come and move you on. This is a traditional form of lifestyle, which is now illegal.
Well, we had all this paranoia, did we not, in the 1980s about the new age travellers, and all sorts of legislation was brought in, and the Criminal Justice Act to try and get rid of illegal raves and so on. What you have periodically is moral panics, where certain things are pointed out to people as being unacceptable and that something's got to be done about them, and the respectable citizens are whipped up into a frenzy. They've probably never even met a traveller, or new age or otherwise, but they're whipped up into a frenzy about it, and the society becomes more intolerant, more divided than ever. And of course we've now got mass youth unemployment, and and loads of Scousers, for example, in the 80s ended up living in country towns in Devon, because if you're going to be permanently unemployed, it makes more sense to be permanently unemployed in Ilfracombe than it does in inner city Liverpool. And we're going to get these kind of tensions again. We've got massive youth unemployment. Young people without sensible things to do tend to be, you know, they do other things that not necessarily so sensible, and you then get divisions, conflicts, and the potential of all sorts of nastiness can come out of that.
So what's your answer to it all then?
Well, we actually got to, as mentioned earlier, what we really need to do is invest for the future. We need an absolutely first-rate youth service to get people motivated. I mean, that's what Prince Charles said when he went round Tottenham. He said, what we need is more youth workers. And it's an obvious thing to do. We need a whole new generation of nursery schools. We need to build social housing. Ed Balls, in the run-up to the Labour Party leadership contest, he said, what we need to do is build a whole new generation of council housing. I thought I'd need to clean my ears out. What's he saying? Whole new generation of council housing? We've not built a single council house in this country for decades, and we wonder why we've got a housing crisis. It's ridiculous.
We've also cut back the grants to people that provide social housing, that is the housing associations as
which
well.
Which all, of course, forces up the price of private houses for those who are lucky enough to get on the property ladder. All that free money. I'm middle class, I'm on the property ladder, where's my free money? And then they whinge on about people living on benefits.
Okay.
What a joke.
Derek, do you want to, Labour councillor, do you want to just finish up on this topic?
Well, I mean, I think social housing is becoming a very, very big issue. Certainly in Bristol, we, like many other cities, we've now got 13, 14, 15,000 people on the housing list. The likelihood of most of them getting social housing is very, very low. We haven't been building. I can't understand why in the last 20 years we haven't had more social housing being built, because it actually stabilises society. We're now, certainly as a local councillor, one of the big problems I've got is people coming and saying they're in the private rented sector, we're now going to have a family, we're going to move on to one income, we just can't afford to cope. How are you going to help us in terms of the provision of affordable social housing? As a councillor, I have to, you know, turn back and say, well, I don't know that I can help you. And that's absolutely ridiculous. And I do think that it's up to local authorities to look again and see how they can find ways to actually start becoming social landlords again.
Because Martin has said in previous weeks here, and I think it's true, that this would actually help kickstart the economy if we were to be building houses.
Well, it would certainly mean that in terms of the construction industry, some people would be getting jobs. And I think there's so many people around who actually do need somewhere decent to live. And that's one of the things, you know, since the Second World War that came out of that, that people were saying, well, no more should we be living in slums. Everybody should have an opportunity to have proper housing. And I think it's as true today as it was then. You know, the amount of social housing we have because of selling off of council houses has shrunk dramatically, particularly, you know, three-bedroom houses for families. And it's about time the local authority was given the opportunity to actually build houses. Somewhere like Bristol, we've got a large land bank where we could build houses. What we need is now the resources to do it.
And to our next story, and police chiefs are facing damaging allegations that they authorised undercover officers embedded in protest groups to give false evidence in court in order to protect their undercover status. Documents seen by The Guardian suggest an undercover officer concealed his true identity from a court when he was prosecuted alongside a group of protesters for occupying a government office during a demonstration. From the moment he was arrested, he gave false name and occupation, maintaining the fiction throughout the entire prosecution, even when he gave evidence under oath to barristers. The officer Jim Boiling and his police handlers never revealed to the activists or to the court who stood alongside him that he was actually an undercover policeman who penetrated their campaign months earlier under a false identity.
Well, I mean, basically this is just illegal tactics by the police. It's entrapment, isn't it? I mean, what kind of role did this person play in planning this illegal action, which then entrapped people, which then led to them being prosecuted and so on and so forth?
One of the other facts, of course, is that this officer would have been privy to all of the defence conversations that were going on between the solicitors Indeed. And the prosecuted. Derek, have you ever come across anything like this before? And what can be done about it?
Well, I haven't come across anything like this before, but I mean, I think we're increasingly hearing that the police are infiltrating different groups, and it's very difficult to say, you know, what the right thing to do is. But as you can't say that when they become so involved in these groups that they're actually outsiders. I think what's been said is, as Martin said, they've become part of it rather than apart from it.
And this is a cycling campaign, and it's almost as if it's being treated like some sort of Al-Qaeda terrorist cell.
Yeah, I think it's you know, again, it's rumours all the time that, you know, these things are going to blow up into something they're not. And I'm sure the police can find better things to do than attack this sort of group.
What about this whole business of oversight? Because we're having a big change in the next few months. So the way that there is, you know, the oversight to the police works, Martin, from the old police authority to an elected police commissioner.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they're happy to have a Republican police commissioner in Belfast, that's fine, because if you politicise this, so you've got one person in charge of policing in an area, no doubt they're hoping that the knee-jerk Daily Mail-type people will be the people... We can't get people to vote in local elections. Getting them to vote for a police commissioner is going to be very, very different. So we're going to have a Labour police commissioner versus a Tory police commissioner versus a Liberal police commissioner. Now, you think how that's going to work in Northern Ireland. We're going to have a Unionist police commissioner, or we're going to have a Republican police commissioner. Now, in actual fact, what you need is an independent police commissioner that's not actually politicised, and their job is to look into, you know, the police should be above politics, and all the political parties in a region or whatever should be on a board to supervise, like the police service of Northern Ireland. Both sections of the community are represented. It's very important that they are. If one person does the job, one community isn't going to be represented, is it?
Now, Derek, what are your thoughts about this whole business of police oversight? Because, you know, next May, it looks like we could be voting on massive changes to the way that the police service is overseen.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are. I think it looks like we are going to get a police commissioner, whether we want one or not. I think Martin's right. I think to put whoever's in charge of the police into a political context like this is wrong. And I think there's going to be all sorts of problems with different police authorities being run by, you know, different parties. And I think it's going to be very difficult to see it work. We would be much better if we had an independent police force.
What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I think independent by you're not having one political party running the police, that they're more independent.
So they should just keep it as it is with the police authority at the moment? Is that working?
Well, I can't see there's a problem with the way it works at the moment, where you do have elected representatives, you have a range of people who are keeping an eye on what's happening. I wasn't aware that the system we have at the moment was broken.
If it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6, thanks to this week's guest, Chair of the Overview and Scrutiny Management Committee on Bristol City Council and Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Derek Pickup. After the news, we go back over 20 years to the Sheffield Wednesday Hillsborough disaster, when 96 Liverpool fans were crushed to death, then had the indignity of being blamed by the Sun newspaper. Plus, where is Werity? That was a headline in the Daily Mail article this week about the invisible advisor and the resignation of Defence Secretary and North Somerset Conservative MP Liam Fox. Coming up after Rupert Murdoch's Sky News at 6.
Live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News.